Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine seeks to highlight the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. We do this by introducing you to the efforts of key government executives, the work of public management practitioners, and the insights of leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of these public management issues we face today. We are in the midst of an exciting, engaging, yet trying period, marked by uncertainty, significant challenges, undeniable opportunities, and indelible aspirations. It's about sharing knowledge and expertise gained from the research we fund and the conversations we commence. We hope to spark the imagination of government leaders to look beyond their day-to-day urgencies and reflect on the serious problems and critical challenges they face today into tomorrow. First up, conversations with leaders, featuring dedicated public servants from a wide variety of disciplines who share their extended reflections on the work they do and the efforts they lead. Advances in biomedical research seek to enhance health and length of life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, plays a significant role in making this happen. U.S. life expectancy has increased dramatically over the past century. Not only are people living longer, they're living healthier lives. However, as Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, notes, science is not a 100-yard dash. It's a marathon run by a relay team that includes researchers, patients, industry experts, lawmakers, and the public. Dr. Collins outlines how basic research prompted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases, and what NIH is doing to advance biomedical research.
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. If we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
This foundation illustrates that basic discovery and the development of therapies go hand in hand. It's about understanding the genesis of disease at the fundamental level. Dr. Collins continues.
Basic science, trying to understand at the fundamental level, what are the causes of various rare diseases? Rare diseases collectively affect about 26 million Americans, and there are about 7,000 of these rare diseases. In the space of just the last 10 years, we've uncovered, using basic science strategies, the molecular basis of about 4,700 of those diseases. Just breathtaking, the rate at which this insight has been coming forward. Of course, that's useful in terms of getting a grasp on what the diseases are all about, but what you really want is to translate that into an intervention. Only about 250 of those diseases currently have any treatment at all.
In the end, it's about turning discovery into action, which, though necessary, is quite risky. Here's Dr. Collins.
By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well, and you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
How does the new National Center for Advancing Translational Science work to make all this a reality? Dr. Collins elaborates.
So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that cause this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically in a way that no single project focus would achieve. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
Today, technological advances are driving science. We need to look no further than the cost of DNA sequencing to see this dynamic at work. The cost curve for sequencing is dropping at a breathtaking rate. Sequencing speed has increased even faster than computer processing speed. Dr. Collins elaborates on the implication of this trend.
If you want to pick an area of technology that just takes your breath away in terms of the speed of its progress, it would be DNA sequencing. That first human genome sequence that I had the privilege of overseeing, the team that managed to pull this off, cost about $400 million when it was completed in 2003. You can now get your human genome sequenced for about $7,000. Think about that, 400 million down to 7,000 in the space of just about 9 years, and the cost continues to plummet. So we will, in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly achieve this goal that many people thought was a bit overly audacious, namely the $1,000 genome, but we're well on the way to achieving that. How will that change things? Well, it already is changing things in cancer, increasingly as part of research studies. And it won't be long before this finds its way into the management of cancer in general, is the desire to know in any given individual's cancer exactly what has gone wrong in those cancer cells that's causing them to grow faster than they're supposed to. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. And now we have the chance to look comprehensively, each individual at a time, in what's gone wrong there and what you might want to do about it. Because knowing that, you can then choose the right combination of targeted therapies that are not one size fits all, but are designed for that person's specific molecular signature. That's just one example. Certainly, all of us in the next decade will probably have the chance to have our complete genome sequences placed into our medical record. That will give insights into what you might be at risk for in the future. It will give insights into, if you fall ill, what drug should be used for you and what dose, because individual differences can be predicted by a study of the DNA. So it is going to transform the way we approach many medical problems, but not overnight. There were some overly optimistic predictions that this was going to happen in the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of driving the cost down to make those things come true.
Why is the work that NIH does so important? Here's Dr. Francis Collins.
I would say there has never been a better time in all of history than right now to come and join this enterprise. We are unraveling mysteries that have puzzled us for all of human history. We're poised to take that information to the next level in terms of preventing and treating disease. We have the chance to bring the basic and the clinical aspects of research together in a very tight connection and a virtuous circle. This would be the moment if you're in any way inclined to get involved in a great detective story that has great answers, come and join the biomedical research team. We've got stuff for you to do.
Since its inception, the country's credit union system has expanded and grown to serve over 93 million Americans. The severe economic crisis impacted all facets of the financial sector, including credit unions. In fact, over 2.5 years ago, the credit union system teetered on the brink of collapse. Debbie Matz, chairman of the National Credit Union Administration, tells us about her agency's history and mission.
The Federal Credit Union Act of 1934 established federal credit unions. The National Credit Union Bureau was established at the time, and it was moved from agency to agency until 1970, when it was established as the National Credit Union Administration as an independent federal regulatory agency. NCUA charters credit unions. We regulate them, we supervise them, and we insure the deposits in federally insured credit unions up to $250,000 per account. So we really are to credit unions what FDIC is to banks.
Matz outlines the size and scope of the work her agency does and how its governance is structured.
NCUA oversees an industry that has $1 trillion in assets, and 93 million Americans have accounts at credit unions. We have a staff of about 1,200 employees, most of whom are examiners. That means that they go into credit unions on a day-to-day basis and make sure they're in regulatory compliance. And they work out of our regional offices. We have 5 regional offices. In Albany, New York, Alexandria, Virginia, Atlanta, Georgia, Tempe, Arizona, and Austin, Texas. And our central office is also in Alexandria, Virginia. In addition to the 5 regional offices, we have 13 major staff offices, which each have a director that either reports to the board or to the top career employee, who is our executive director. Credit unions pay 1% of their deposits, and that establishes the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. And that's the fund that guarantees the deposits up to $250,000. And there's currently $11 billion in the share insurance fund. NCUA has a 3-member board. All the board members are Senate confirmed, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate for 6-year terms. The chairman is generally of the same party as the president, and the board sets the policy and the direction for the staff offices.
What does the future hold for credit unions? Once again, Chairman Debbie Matz.
Well, that's something that I talk to credit unions about in just about every speech that I give. I remind them that if they want to be around in 10 years, they need to attract younger members. And in order to attract younger members, they need to provide the services and the tools that younger members need and desire. So, for instance, they need to make sure that they're embracing technology. They need to reach out to young people and get them to understand that credit unions are a good value, because generally in a marketplace, credit unions charge less interest on loans and pay higher interest on accounts. And so that's an important message for young people to know. I always encourage credit unions to reach out to young people in every way that they can, because that's their future.
Good government, that is government fiscally responsible to its people, has as its charge making operations more responsive, efficient, and accountable, getting rid of waste and saving money. In an era of tight budgets, this charge has taken on significance beyond the fundamentals to encompass the government-wide improvement of financial management. Danny Warfel, controller of the Office of Federal Financial Management within OMB, highlights the top federal financial management priorities.
It's either about cutting waste or it's about building a government for the 21st century. We have this initiative we call the Campaign to Cut Waste. It was launched by the president through an executive order, put the vice president in charge of it. We have a whole variety of different things we're trying to achieve under the Campaign to Cut Waste. We are cutting administrative savings, things like IT, printing, and travel, vehicles or fleet. You know, this is kind of the bread and butter stuff that won't necessarily, you know, eliminate our deficit by any stretch, but represent two things. First, they represent, you know, every dollar counts, and these are practical things that can be done. We don't have to get rid of an automobile. That's fine just because we're interested in the next upgrade. We can hold on to our vehicles longer. You know, we don't need a printer on every desk. Mm-hmm. We don't need to travel just for the sake of travel without a critical purpose for that travel. We issued that 20% cut requirement back in November of 2011, and then we put in the president's budget all the agency's commitments on that 20% cut, and it totaled $8 billion. And then within the campaign to cut waste, there's other things. There's improper payments. There's managing our real estate more effectively. And I'd say on the 21st century government, there's a lot going on, but to pick a top priority, I'd pick how are we going to move forward in open government and transparency. And in particular, where I have the most responsibility and where I lose the most sleep at night is how are we making federal spending more transparent? All of those things are part of a strategic set of priorities that I'm working on with the financial management community.
The federal government disperses trillions of dollars in payments every year. Unfortunately, there are instances where the government makes payments that are improper. Addressing improper payments is a central component of the administration's efforts to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. Here's Danny Warfel.
We pay a lot of money out. We pay benefits to individuals. We pay contractors. We reimburse doctors for Medicare bills, grants to states, all different variations of payments. We guarantee loans, et cetera. And we make mistakes. The money goes in the wrong amount. It can go to the wrong individual. It could go in the right amount to the right individual, but then be used for the wrong purpose. And so these are the types of mistakes. The more typical improper payment occurs when we lack the ability to validate whether the payment is right or not. The largest sources of error in the government are in Medicare and Medicaid. They make up half our balance sheet. And there's a whole different, you know, it's a very complex terrain in terms of how we can make different types of errors in Medicare. Sometimes the issues can be really, really challenging to authenticate. But within all of this, what we've tried to do is find the errors where we have the best chance of initiating changes to improve. And there are some promising areas where we are leveraging data and technology and innovations in ways to drive down these errors, and I'm very excited about that.
Looking forward, thinking about the road ahead, Danny Warfel continues about the future of federal financial management.
Well, I think the number one challenge that everyone, and I think if no matter who you had sitting in this chair, if you have a government leader, they're likely to answer this question, you know, people. Mm-hmm. And human resources or human capital. You know, we have a lot of individuals in the federal government that are eligible to retire. So there's some succession planning and recruitment. And then also the challenges are changing and the skill sets change with them. Much more specifically in the financial management community, analytics are becoming more important as we figure out how to put kind of traditional accounting functions on a more stable platform. It enables us to shift into more analysis rather than blocking and tackling and nuts and bolts accounting, which is a great thing to be able to do. But you have to have the right skill sets in order to drive those analytics. And it was everything we talked about today in terms of executing on a set of results to cut waste or to bring government in the 21st century. The road to get there is clearer and ultimately shorter if you are driving strategic decisions about what you're investing in, what your critical path is. And those strategic decisions are based on analysis. They're based on looking at data, at looking at our organization, at looking at our business processes, and figuring out what the right navigation points going forward are to be successful.
We'll continue with our conversation with leaders when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.